You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service, and it is time for our birthdays. So for today, May 3rd, happy birthday to Mildred Gass of Ankeny, and a very happy birthday to Ronald Wilson of Adair. I hope both of you have a wonderful day today. And joining you today, some celebrity birthdays. Singer Frankie Valli is 90. Bassist Pete Staples, who plays for the Trogs, is 80. Sportscaster Greg Gumbel is 78. Singer-guitarist Christopher Cross is 73. Bassist Bruce Hall for the REO Speedwagon is 71. And drummer Sterling Campbell from the B-52s is 60. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here is Judith with the first of our obituaries.
And we have one obituary today from Lake Wells, Florida. William Memo James Essie, 78, passed away peacefully on April 15, surrounded by his family in Lake Wells, Florida. Bill was born on October 8, 1945, in Des Moines, to Edward and Ann Essie. He later moved to Medora, Iowa, where he married his wife Marcy on May 10, 1986. Bill was affectionately known as Memo to many. He spent his winters in Acumal, Mexico, where he and his wife raised their youngest son. Bill was a pioneer in the town of Acumal, where he enjoyed camping and being active in the community. He and Marcy owned and ran the historic Iowa Theater in Winterset, Iowa. Bill was especially proud of his family's Italian and Phoenician heritage. Bill was preceded in death by his father, Edward Essie, and his mother, Ann Judiesi Essie. He is survived by his wife, Marcy, of Lake Wells, Florida, two sons, Jeff of New Virginia and Lucas of Lake Wells, grandson Ryan of Des Moines, brothers John, married to Carol, of Lake Wells, Florida, and Mark, married to Jackie, of West Des Moines. A memorial service will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. on May 9 at Christopher's, located at 2816 Beaver Avenue, Des Moines, Iowa. Memorial contributions can be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital.
Now we will continue with our national and international news. Trial resumes with gag order hearing. Lawyer for Daniels, McDougal, continues testifying in Trump case. This is written by Aisha Bagchi, Kinsley Crowley, and David Jackson for the USA Today. Dateline, New York. The 10th day of former President Donald Trump's historic New York hush money trial started with another hearing about whether he was, in layperson's terms, illegally running his mouth. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee is accused of falsifying business records to cover up unlawful interference in the 2016 election through a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. He has pleaded not guilty. The gag order prohibits Trump from publicly commenting on potential witnesses or jurors, among other strictures. In imposing the order, Judge Juan Merchan noted a history of Trump making inflammatory statements that created fear and security needs for people tied to his legal cases. Merchan already held Trump in criminal contempt Tuesday for concluding he committed 9 violations, totaling $9,000 in fines. He warned future violations would mean jail time. Thursday's hearing centered on 4 more alleged violations. The defendant thinks the rules should be different for him, prosecutor Christopher Conroy said. He described Trump's statements as corrosive to this proceeding and to the fair administration of justice. Trump lawyer Todd Blanche said that his client was merely responding to repeated attacks, which the order allows him to do. One example was a post Trump's former lawyer and potential witness Michael Cohen made on X, formerly Twitter, that said, "Keep whining, crying, and violating the gag order, you petulant defendant." Blanche complained about alleged violations where Trump said something completely neutral or positive, such as his comment about former tabloid executive David Pecker, who testified last week. David's been very nice, a nice guy. Merchan said he understood that Blanche's concerns about Cohen, but he said it's also about what other witnesses observe. Such comments could affect them, which does go to the integrity of the proceedings. As for comments Trump made about jurors, Blanche argued that there were constitutional limits protecting Trump's speech rights in relation to his presidential campaign. Blanche said his team believes that it is political persecution and that part of their belief is tied to the jurisdiction of the trial. The judge didn't seem to have much respect for that argument. The judge did not immediately rule on the new alleged violations. It took him a week to issue the fines for the first gag order hearing. After a break, lawyer Keith Davidson retook the stand. He represented Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal in their deals ahead of the 2016 election to stay quiet about alleged affairs with Trump. Prosecutor Joshua Steinglass continued asking Davidson about emails with Cohen, about getting paid. Davidson said he did finally receive the $130,000 Cohen promised as part of the Daniels deal. He made $10,000 personally. Trump was referred to as David Dennison in that deal. Daniels was referred to as Peggy Peterson. What have we done? Davidson texted National Enquirer editor Dylan Howard on the night of 2016 election, presidential election, according to text messages displayed in the courtroom. Oh, my God, Howard responded. Davidson testified his message was humorous. Pressed further, he said that the message reflected his belief that his and Howard's activities may have in some way helped Trump's campaign. The prosecution also parsed a 2018 statement Daniels made when news of the payment came out, denying an alleged sexual relationship with Trump, which Davidson wrote. I think it's technically true, Davidson said. He didn't believe anyone alleged that there was a relationship between Daniels and Trump. On the same day, Daniels appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live when the host asked her, "Have you ever made love to someone whose name rhymes with Lonald Lump?" She responded, "I'll call you whatever you want me to call you, baby." In cross-examination, defense attorneys Emil Bove grilled Davidson about his past deals, seeking to portray him as an extortionist who dealt in cash for dirt. The line of questioning hinted at a strategy by Trump's legal team to undermine the credibility of prosecution witnesses. Bove asked about Davidson's alleged efforts to seek cash from Hulk Hogan in exchange for a sex tape involving the former pro wrestler. He also asked Davidson about attempts to trade embarrassing information for cash from actor Charlie Sheen and reality TV star Tyla Tequila. Asked whether Sheen had paid one of Davidson's clients $2 million, Davidson replied, "I don't recall." He said he had too many clients to remember all the deals. "You were pretty well versed in getting right up on the line without commenting on extortion, or without committing extortion, right?" Bove asked. Davidson denied ever committing extortion, and he didn't sound happy about the questions. When Bove challenged Davidson's testimony at one point, Davidson bit back. "You're getting truthful answers, sir," with emphasis on the last word, sir. Bove later applied the same line of questioning to the Daniels deals, suggesting the 2016 presidential election was used as leverage to get the hush money. Davidson also answered questions about a December 9th, 2016 phone call with Cohen. "Trump's lawyer sounded so bad that day. I thought he was going to kill himself," Davidson said. Cohen's concern on the call was that he wasn't going to get a position in Trump's presidential administration. Davidson said Cohen had previously raised the possibility of being Trump's chief of staff or becoming the United States Attorney General. As Trump left the courthouse Thursday, he suggested he would not testify in the trial because of the judge's gag order, even though one has nothing to do with the other. "I'm not allowed to testify. I'm under a gag order, I guess, right?" Trump told reporters. Trump also said he has appealed the gag order, which does not preclude testimony in open court.
Conservative states sue government over gun rule. This by from Page Six, story by George Fabe Russell, from the Fort Smith Southwest Times Record. Little Rock, Arkansas. A coalition of 21 conservative states, led by Arkansas, filed a lawsuit Wednesday challenging a new federal rule regulating licenses for gun dealers. The rule is meant to clarify definitions and help implement the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act of 2022, which the White House has called the only significant expansion of the background check requirement since 1993. The rule broadens the definition of when a person is considered a firearms dealer and therefore must be licensed and required to run background checks on the people they sell guns to, according to the rule adopted on April 19. At a news conference Wednesday, Arkansas Attorney General Tim Griffin called the rule an attempt to do what the administration could not get through the Congress, as well as arbitrary and capricious. They do not have the power to do this unilaterally via fiat, Griffin said. He went on to say, this proposed rule does not help clarify anything and should have to go through the Congress. Griffin is co-leading the suit with Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach as part of a 21-state coalition. The lawsuit was filed in federal court in Little Rock. The other states include Iowa, Montana, Alabama, Alaska, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Kentucky, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming, as well as several individuals and a gun collector group. Griffin cited the March search warrant raid carried out by alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosive agents, in which the director of Little Rock's airport was killed in a shootout. Brian Malinowski was suspected of dealing firearms without a license, and the pre-dawn raid at his home was intended to seize some of the more than 150 guns that he had bought since 2021. Griffin said, for whatever reason, the ATF believed that Malinowski had somehow met the nebulous, somewhat subjective standard of being in the business of dealing firearms. There was confusion and a lack of clarity as to where the line was before, and this new rule does not help. If you are going to be put in that situation based on your conduct, there is a heightened obligation on the government to provide guidance. The raid took place before the new rule was announced. According to the lawsuit, only those who repetitively purchased and sold firearms as a regular course of business had to become a licensee. The lawsuit alleges the new rule has the practical effect of requiring background checks for a large number of firearm sales that would not have been required under the prior definitions of engaged in the business. Under the rule, the lawsuit says anyone who sells or resells even one firearm with the intent to profit, no matter how little, combined with other nebulously defined evidence, is a firearms dealer who must become a licensee. In an April 11th statement from the White House announcing the rule emphasized a seller's intent, saying that a person selling just one gun and then saying to others they are willing and able to purchase more firearms for resale may be required to obtain a license and run background checks. In the past, people selling firearms at gun shows were not required to be licensed as a dealer or run background checks on their customers. In the statement, the Biden administration said under the rule, the gun show or online sale loopholes do not exist, and that if you are conducting business, that in a brick and mortar store would require you to become a licensed dealer. You have to become a licensed dealer and run background checks.
Intelligence chief, Ukraine war not likely to end anytime soon. Jonathan Landy and Idris Ali are writing this. Dateline, Washington. Russian President Vladimir Putin sees domestic and international developments trending in his favor and likely will press on with aggressive tactics in Ukraine, but the war is unlikely to end soon, the top U.S. intelligence officials said on Thursday. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines told the Senate Armed Services Committee that Russia has intensified strikes on Ukraine's infrastructure to hamper Kyiv's ability to move arms and troops, slow defense production, and force it to consider negotiations. Putin's increasingly aggressive tactics against Ukraine, such as strikes of Ukraine's electricity infrastructure, are intended to impress Ukraine that continuing to fight will only increase the damage to Ukraine and offer no plausible path to victory, she said. These aggressive tactics are likely to continue, and the war is unlikely to end anytime soon, Haines said. She and Lieutenant General Jeffrey Cruz, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, were testifying before the Committee on the Intelligence Community's 2024 assessment of the threats facing the United States. On China, considered by the United States as its main global rival, Haines and Chinese President Xi Jinping said his top leaders expect some future instability in relations with Washington, but, she continued, they will seek to project stability in those ties as their top priority is grappling with China's troubled economy, rather than pursue policies to stimulate consumer spending or encourage investment. They appear to be doubling down on a long-term strategy driven by manufacturing and technological innovation, she said. That approach, however, will almost certainly deepen public and investment pessimism over the near term. China is grappling with economic headwinds, including tepid domestic demand, high youth unemployment, and a property crisis. Beijing has ramped up infrastructure investment and turned to investing in high-tech manufacturing, but some economists warn that that could exacerbate long-term imbalances. Xi and his top leaders are growing concerned about the U.S.'s ability to disrupt China's technological goals and have modified their approach to economic retaliation against the United States by imposing at least some tangible costs on U.S. firms, Haines said. She apparently was referring to raids on U.S. companies that have chilled China's foreign business environment and Beijing's expansion of restrictions on U.S. technology applications.
Hamas chief and officials discuss ceasefire. This story by Nadal A. Mourabi, Daphne Saladakis, and Simon Lewis from Reuters. From Cairo, Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh discussed the ongoing Gaza ceasefire talks in separate phone calls with Egypt's intelligence chief Abbas Kamel and Qatar's prime minister and foreign minister Mohammed bin Abdurrahman Al Thani. A statement by the Palestinian Islamist group on Thursday said a delegation is set to visit Egypt soon for further ceasefire talks in the Gaza war. The statement added that Haniyeh had affirmed the group's positive spirit in studying the ceasefire proposal in the phone call with Egypt's Kamel. Hamas said on Saturday that it had received Israel's latest position and would study it before submitting a reply. The Egyptian state-affiliated Al-Qahira News quoted an unidentified high-level Egyptian source as saying that the Hamas delegation would arrive in Cairo in the next 2 days. Speaking to Reuters, a Palestinian official close to the mediation also said the Hamas delegation's visit could take place in the next 2 days. Speaking to Reuters, a Palestinian official close to the mediation also said the Hamas delegation's visit could take place, in the next 2 days. Hamas's statement added that the negotiations to be held in Cairo aim to mature a deal that achieves the demands of our people and ends the aggression. Another statement by Hamas on Thursday said that Haniyeh and Qatar's prime minister agreed to continue the ongoing discussions to mature a deal through Qatari and Egyptian mediation. Egypt recently renewed its bid to push stalled negotiations between Israel and Hamas to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. The United States on Thursday called on both Israel and Hamas to ensure that aid bound for civilians in Gaza is not disrupted after a shipment from Jordan was attacked by Israeli settlers and subsequently diverted by Palestinian militants. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken viewed the aid on Tuesday just before it departed from the headquarters of the Jordan Hashemite Charity Organizations in Amman, bound for the newly opened crossing into Gaza at Erez. The visit was part of a United States push to increase the aid getting to civilians in Gaza amid warnings of imminent famine after nearly 7 months of war stemming from Hamas's October 7 attacks in southern Israel. Before the shipment reached the crossing, however, Jordan said it was attacked by Israeli settlers. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters that Blinken raised the incident with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Wednesday and credited Israel for arresting three people involved in the attack. Miller said that is the step that they ought to take whenever there are attacks on aid convoys. Furthermore, they ought to prevent these attacks from happening in the first place. The same aid convoy was later transferred to a humanitarian aid group to be distributed inside Gaza, but was intercepted and diverted by Hamas, Miller said, adding that he believed the United Nations either had or was in the process of recovering the aid. Miller said it was an unacceptable act by Hamas to divert this aid to begin with, to seize this aid. Rebuilding homes in the Gaza Strip could drag into the next century if the pace follows the trend of previous conflicts, according to a United Nations report released on Thursday. Nearly 7 months of Israeli bombardment had caused billions of dollars in damage, leaving many of the crowded strip's high-rise concrete buildings reduced to heaps, with the United Nations official referring to a moonscape of destruction. The assessment, released by the UN Development Program, said Gaza needs approximately 80 years to restore all the fully destroyed housing units. However, in a best-case scenario, in which construction materials are delivered five times as fast as in the last crisis in 2021, it could be done by 2040, the report said. The UNDP assessment makes a series of projections on the war's socioeconomic impact based on the duration of the current conflict, projecting decades of ongoing suffering. The UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner said in a statement, "Unprecedented levels of human losses, capital destruction, and the steep rise in poverty in such a short period of time will precipitate a serious development crisis that jeopardizes the futures of generations to come. In a scenario where the war lasts 9 months, poverty is set to increase from 38.8% of Gaza's population at the end of 2023 to 60.7%, dragging a large portion of the middle class below the poverty line," the report said. Netanyahu secured another reprieve in a long-running Israeli dispute over exemptions of ultra-Orthodox Jews from military service, with the Supreme Court on Thursday deferring the deadline for a new conscription plan to May 16. The court, hearing appeals that described the decades-old waiver as discriminatory, had given March 31st as the original deadline. That was extended to April 30th at the request of the government, which argued it was busy waging the Gaza war and which last week asked for a further deferral. Netanyahu's coalition includes two ultra-Orthodox parties that regard the exemptions as key to keeping their constituents in religious seminaries and away from a melting pot military that might test their conservative values. The ultra-Orthodox make up 13% of Israel's 10 million population, a figure expected to reach 19% by 2035 due to their high birth rates. Economists argue that the conscription waiver keeps some of the community unnecessarily out of the workforce, spelling a growing welfare burden for middle-class taxpayers.
And now to finish out our portion here until 10:30, we'll go back to the 50 states. The highlight today is Rhode Island. Cranston, Rhode Island, tucked behind the Rhode Island Training School, lies some 1,049 headstones, marked not with names, but with numbers. They represent the indigent and mentally ill people buried anonymously at the State Farm Cemetery annex grounds from 1875 through the early 1900s, and they will now be part of the school's curriculum. Students will explore the basic identities of the people buried there, their countries of origin, causes of death, and more as part of an experimental learning project in an experiential learning project in partnership with Tea Time Productions, a company whose mission is shining light on untold or little known stories. And now to continue with our neighboring states from Minnesota, St. Paul, a truck driver has been charged in the death of an Iowa couple after details emerged that he was watching a show on Netflix while driving, resulting in a car accident that killed the two in Minnesota. From Wisconsin, Milwaukee, a National Community Violence Intervention Coalition will bring its resources and up to $500,000 in funding to Milwaukee. The Coalition to Advance Public Safety is a Black-led collaborative effort focused on reducing near-term violence over the next 5 years by 10% to 20% across 12 cities at the Center of America's Battle Against Gun Violence, a news release from the group states. From South Dakota, Pierre, South Dakota's six public universities controlled by the Board of Regents are starting to enforce a new communications and branding policy the Regents passed in December. From South Sioux City, Nebraska, the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Extension and South Dakota State University Extension are hosting a Siouxland Feedlot Forum on June 18th in South Sioux City. And from Missouri, Springfield, Missouri, a cardiologist is suing Cox Health for wrongly removing his admitting privileges and reporting to national organizations and federal agencies that the doctor was an immediate threat to the public. And then kind of starting up with the alphabet here. From Montgomery, Alabama, an Alabama State Committee approved a $10 million appropriation for summer EBT administrative funding, which allows for schools to assist families who benefit from free and reduced school lunch programs while schools are out during the summer. From Fairbanks, Alaska, the University of Alaska announced that the school and the Alaska Graduate Workers Association have agreed on a labor contract that would last through the end of 2026, the Alaska Beacon reported. From Phoenix, Arizona, in 1980, Chris Grecius, a seven-year-old boy from Scottsdale battling leukemia, had his wish granted of becoming an honorary Arizona Department of Public Safety officer for a day, leading to the establishment of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. To commemorate Grecius, a bronze sculpture made in his likeness was installed in 2018. 5 years later, the statue was stolen. On Tuesday, Make-A-Wish Arizona unveiled a return of the Chris Grecius statue, which was remade from its original casting at the Parsons Wish House in Scottsdale. From Little Rock, Arkansas, the Wingate Foundation is giving $93,500 grant to the University of Arkansas Pulaski Technical College Foundation to expand the school's nursing program, KATV reported. From Los Angeles, California, the parents of a four-year-old who believed to have been tortured and killed in Southern California were sentenced to decades in prison. From Fort Collins, Colorado, a bat found on a porch has tested positive for rabies, marking the first confirmed case of an animal with the deadly virus in Larimer County this year. And from Willimantic, Connecticut, a home health care company is being fined over $163,000 after an investigation found that the company did not provide adequate safeguards to protect a visiting nurse who was killed during an appointment with a convicted sex offender last October, federal workplace safety officials said. And from Dover, Delaware, when a person in Delaware mails a letter addressed to a person held in one of the state's four prison facilities, that correspondence must travel more than 4,000 miles to Las Vegas before eventually returning to Delaware and its intended recipient. The long detour for about 3,000 pieces of mail sent each month to Delaware's prisons is part of their Department of Corrections' new mail screening processes that was implemented at each of the state's prisons and jail lockups after a recent year-long test period at the state's largest prison. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Lisa Horsch and Judith Linden. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We're going to continue with opinions and sports from the Des Moines Register, and if there's time, some more news from USA Today. And here is Jim with our first opinion piece.
Thank you, Rachel. And we begin with an article written by Chris Brennan of USA Today. He's an elections columnist. If Trump breaks gag order again, jail him. Donald Trump spent most of his adult life testing the limits of what he can get away with. That way of life cost him $9,000 for contempt of court in the first of his four criminal trials. Trump had been repeatedly warned, but like in previous court cases, could not control himself. His next transgression, and history strongly suggests there will be another, must sting more than a four-figure fine for a billionaire politician who raises millions from his supporters by playing victim to being held accountable. New York Judge Juan Merchan must jail Trump for at least one night if he steps out of bounds again. It might be the only way to get through to him. Trump is a control freak, freaked out by his lack of control in a dingy Manhattan courtroom. He must sit still and silently listen to the seedy allegations against him. Michael Cohen, a once loyal lawyer and fixer, will spell out at some point in the trial exactly how he says Trump paid $130,000 in 2016 to keep a porn star quiet about a sexual encounter out of fear that it could impact the presidential election that year. Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, gets a shot at telling her story too. And she's not so impressed with the defendant, who long styled himself as New York City's most interesting Lothario celebrity. Their testimony will deconstruct the story of Trump, as told by Trump, and the notion that he commands fealty from his inner circle. Trump was already primed to erupt. He continually complains about how cold the courtroom is. He seems convinced the courtroom artist is out to get him. And hours in court inhibit his well-known habit of downing Diet Cokes, which may contribute to his tendency to nod off while an audience mocks him. Merchan's order finding Trump in contempt Tuesday could be the thing that prompts his next gag order violation outburst. The judge cites seven posts Trump made on his social media site, Truth Social, and two posts on his campaign website this month as violations of the order. Each one carried a $1,000 fine, and he must remove the posts. But it's Merchan's conclusion that shows the real looming threat. The order warns that the court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment. That's what the prosecutors have asked for if Trump again violates the order, and they've played a winning hand so far. Merchan agreed with them in 9 out of 10 instances where they accused Trump of crossing the line. And Trump's defense is challenging those claims was so inadequate that the judge warned his lawyer last week, "You're losing all credibility." Trump has been awake long enough in this trial to know that things are going badly for him, and there's nothing he can do about it. So we've got prosecutors who want Trump jailed if he violates the order again. And we have a judge who seems willing to jail Trump if necessary. How will Trump respond? We know from his recent civil court defeats that Trump doesn't learn much of a lesson about contempt on his first or second try. He was found to be in contempt 2 years ago for not turning over documents in a New York civil case that accused his company of engaging in business fraud in how it valued its properties. That put in place a $10,000 per day fine that eventually reached $110,000 before Trump paid up. During a civil trial in October, New York Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron fined Trump $5,000 for contempt of court for a social media post attacking his court clerk, and then $10,000 the following week when Trump repeated the attack while speaking with reporters outside the courtroom. Trump lost that case in February, and the $454 million verdict stands as he appeals. Trump also pushed his luck in another civil case that ended with a verdict holding him liable for defaming the writer E. Jean Carroll. Judge Lewis Kaplan, hearing the case that ended with Trump on the hook for $83.3 million in punitive and compensatory damages, threatened at one point to have Trump removed from the courtroom for loudly muttering during testimony. "Mr. Trump, I hope I don't have to consider excluding you from the trial," Kaplan warned. "I do understand you're probably eager for me to do that." "I would love it," Trump told the judge. "You just can't control yourself in these circumstances, apparently," Kaplan said to that. That's the ball game for Trump. He can't control himself. To do so would be to acknowledge a flaw in how he behaves. He could never muster that type of introspection. So Trump attacks and attacks and attacks. That's what he's likely to do here. It's his only way of thinking. He's boxed in by his own lack of imagination. So box Trump in for real if he pulls another stunt. Put him behind bars. Lock the cell door. Feed him jail food. Make him follow jail rules and a jail schedule. Finally, take control of the control freak, if only to let him know it can't happen.
The other piece on the opinion page is by Elisha Wiesel, and there is a photograph of his father, Holocaust survivor and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel, taken in 2009, that accompanies the piece. "It was freshman year. I was home for a holiday weekend, and the nation was awaiting the outcome of a Supreme Court case that was the talk of campus. Over dinner, I shared my views. 'The right to burn the flag,' I told my parents with 18-year-old certainty, 'is a far more beautiful thing than the flag itself. We should be inspired when we see the flag being burned because it means we are free.' I can count on one hand the number of times I saw my father, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel, angry. This is the only time I can remember him being angry at me. My father's face darkened as he pushed back his chair and stood up from the table. 'If you had been there,' he said in a voice I had never heard him use before, 'if you had been there when Buchenwald was liberated, if you had seen that flag being carried that day, that flag meant to the soldiers who had seen their brothers killed trying to reach us. My father, a Holocaust survivor, said to me, 'If you knew what that flag meant to me then and means to me now, you would never utter such foolishness at my table.' I was ashamed. My obsession with one truth, that civil liberties were a treasure to be protected, had prevented me from seeing a truth that stood just as strongly beside it. Not everything that is legal is right. Not everything that can be said should. My parents had endured unspeakable horrors to arrive at this promised, if imperfect, land, to make common cause with her most deeply held values. I had been not only ungrateful, but blind. I tell you this story to share how he taught. What he didn't do mattered as much as what he did. My father didn't threaten to cut off my tuition. He didn't love me any less the next day. But symbols have meaning. Words have meaning. There was history I needed to hear to inform the ideological viewpoint I was developing, and he made sure I heard it. To be young is to explore. Students are expected to experiment with different ideas and worldviews, and universities, like parents, have a responsibility to guide them. Not every student in the ongoing pro-Palestinian demonstrations has burned the American flag or screamed death to America or expressed fervor for Osama bin Laden, although these are shocking moments caught on camera that we cannot unsee or unhear. But by the hundreds, they are shouting genocidal phrases in a cult-like call-and-response fashion, led by the demagogue extremists who have taken over their campuses. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Globalize the Intifada. We don't want two states, we want all of 48. Why are so many taking part in this call to violence? Some are surely there, not because they have a deep understanding of the Middle East, nor even necessarily tremendous empathy, but for the excitement, the illusion of camaraderie, the chance to demonstrate to their classmates that they are as righteous and revolutionary as anyone else. The demagogues offer them a chance to be part of the club. All one needs to do is treat the Jews as the other, the one nation not allowed to defend itself from rape, terror, and murder. And surely some are there out of genuine compassion and the desire to follow their conscience. We have no way of knowing what is in their hearts, but all who chant these slogans must agree to the same price. Blame the Jews. Universities are obliged to allow free speech. They are also obliged to make sure that every one of their students can attend their classes free of harassment and verbal assault. But above all, universities are obliged to teach. Our enemies accuse us of colonizing Palestine. Where are the professors of history who have studied the archaeological and written records, which include the New Testament and the Quran, that connect the ancient Jews to Israel? Why are they silent? Our enemies insist that the Jews do not need our own nation. Where are the faculty who should be pointing out that when European Jewry needed shelter from the Nazis, no other nation would offer them refuge? Our enemies accuse Israel of genocide. Where are the history lessons on the blood libel, the historical precedent for accusing Jews of murder, on the repeated Palestinian rejection of Israel's offers of self-rule, land, and peace that dispel the genocide lie completely? On the actual definition of genocide. Universities need to deliver severe consequences for the extremists who have fanned this hatred on campus. For all the other students involved, universities should create a path for education and forgiveness without shying away from pointing out the depth of their error. What might have happened, what might have been prevented, had German universities given students the knowledge to question what they were taught about the Jews in the 1930s? What if enough students had decided to stop parroting the words their classmates uttered? What if they had broken free of the machine that slaughtered my family? If anti-Semitism depends on the context, then give these students the context they need to temper their ideology, just as my father did for me so many years ago. It's time for university leaders to do their job. It's time for them to teach. Again, that's by Elisha Wiesel, the son of Marion Wiesel and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel.
Thank you, Rachel. We turn our attention to sports in the Des Moines Register, and we have the sports TV schedule to pass along to you. From the National Basketball Association, starting at 6 o'clock on ESPN, we have the Boston-Miami game, and at 8:30 on ESPN as well, LA Clippers are at Dallas. Major League Baseball, several games available at 1:20 this afternoon on the Major League Baseball Network. Milwaukee is at the Chicago Cubs. At 5:40 this evening, Apple TV Plus, we've got the Giants at the Phillies. And at 5:45 on Apple TV Plus, Toronto at Washington. 6:05, Major League Baseball Network, we've got the Tigers at the Yankees. And at 6:10 on Major League Baseball Network, LA Angels at Cleveland. At 8:40, Major League Baseball Network, San Diego at Arizona. And ESPN Plus, Miami's at Oakland. And 9:10 p.m., another game, Major League Baseball Network, we've got Atlanta at the LA Dodgers. And one soccer game in the English Premier League at 2 p.m. On Peacock, Everton at Luton Town. We also have the Register's Athletes of the Week to let you know about. Hull Zuber voted as Register's Athletes of the Week. This written by Joe Randleman of the Des Moines Register. Underwood girls soccer player Taylor Hull and Ankeny boys track and field athlete Ethan Zuber were voted the Des Moines Register's Iowa Ortho Female and Male Athlete of the Week winners for the week of April 22nd to the 28th. Hull won Female Athlete of the Week with 38% of the vote. She won a close battle over West Des Moines Valley girls track and field athlete Addison Dornkamp, who received 33%. Hull had a huge night offensively for the Class 1A No. 6 Underwood soccer team during a 7-0 victory over Harlan on April 23rd. Hull put up an impressive 6 goals to help the Eagles improve to 8-1. Zuber won Male Athlete of the Week with 60% of the vote. Norwalk boys track and field athlete Tony Anania took second with 39% as those two dominated the voting. Zuber anchored Ankeny to a Drake Relays record time in his 4x800 relay, and he placed second in both the 3200 and the 1600. The Ankeny boys 4x800 team ran a time of 7 minutes 39.54 seconds to break the old record of 7:45.3 set by Marshalltown back in 1985. Zuber ran the 3200 in 8:56.68, which broke the old relays record of 8:58.27. set by Dallas center Grimes Alden Ramsey in 2022. But he had to settle for second by Cedar Falls' Jaden Merrick, who won in an even faster 8:55.14. In the 1600, Zuber clocked in at 4:09.49, but again he finished behind a relays record setter.
We have a few minutes. I might have to edit this article a bit, but it's by Rick Brown, who was a sports columnist for the Des Moines Register for a whole bunch of years. And he's writing about his colleague, Randy Peterson. Columnist Randy Peterson says he's retiring, but I'm skeptical, said Rick Brown. Randy Peterson has decided to retire. Call me skeptical. I say that because no one has enjoyed chasing the written word more than my friend for the last 5 decades. He is, as the Des Moines Register's legendary columnist Maury White would have called him, an ink-stained ragamuffin. That's a compliment, by the way. And Randy loved his job as much as anyone I've ever known. I spent the summer of 1975 as a sports intern at the Register. I'd get to the office about the time Randy, who was on the staff of the Des Moines Tribune at the time, was leaving. He already had first-name status by then. Mention the word Pete to any prep coach in Greater Des Moines, and they knew who you were talking about. Over the years, his stories filled countless scrapbooks. Pete and I covered a lot of sporting events together over the years, from the football playoffs to the state softball tournament, state basketball tournaments to the Drake relays, college football and basketball games, golf tournaments, and who knows what else. While on the road, we solved life's problems at places like the Panther Lounge in Cedar Falls and Van's Chat and Chew Cafe in Atlantic. When you traveled with Randy, it was a guarantee. You'd be the first one to arrive and the last one to leave. In between, he covered a lot of ground, talking to anyone he came across looking for a newsy nugget he could use in his story. From the day he stood up in my wedding in 1982 to the time I said goodbye to the newspaper life in 2015, Pete never changed. Often with a Diet Coke in one hand and a notebook or his tape recorder in the other, he was always in search of the next story. And now, Pete is joining those flannel uniforms by turning the page on his newspaper career. It's a new life that doesn't include, as Bob Seger sang in Against the Wind, deadlines and commitments, what to leave in, what to leave out. Pete will miss those deadlines for a while. He'll miss the games, the post-game interviews, and the positive spin. He'll miss the relationships with coaches and athletes, and he'll miss the chase. But he'll always have his 5+ decades of memories to remember as he looks out at West Lake Okoboji and reflects on a career well done. Written by Randy Peterson's friend, Rick Brown. It's time to turn to Dear Abby in today's paper. There's, as usual, 2 letters and 2 responses. I'll start and then Jim will pick it up. My sister Sandy divorced her husband 15 years ago. Her oldest son, Nick, has never gotten over it. He's 30 now and has treated her badly over the years. He not only vandalized her home, but has also said horrible things to her. She maintained a relationship with him despite his behavior supporting him emotionally and sometimes financially. Sandy has been engaged to her long-term boyfriend for 3 years, but Nick is hostile toward him. He calls him names, denigrates his faith, and refuses to accept him as part of the family. Her fiancé has grown tired of this treatment, and I'm afraid it may cause their breakup. My sister doesn't want to lose her son over this, and everyone in our family, including the other children, loves Nick. What can she do? Signed, Cease Dysfunction in New Mexico. Abby writes, Dear Cease, what your sister should do depends upon what's more important to her. If losing her fiancé to maintain a relationship with her disrespectful and unloving son is paramount, she should end their romantic relationship. Of course, it won't change her son's deplorable behavior, and she will have to accept that. Or she can decide to go on with her life and possibly marry her gentleman friend. The rest of the family can continue to love Nick as much as they wish, and everyone will be happier. P.S. I can't help but wonder why this letter came from you and not from your sister. The most unwelcome advice is that which is unsolicited.
And our second letter, Dear Abby, as far as I'm concerned, my marriage is over. For the past 10 years or more, my wife has recklessly spent our joint savings and my pension savings, taken out credit cards in my name without my knowledge, and put us through bankruptcy. We now have over $50,000 in debt with nothing left. She has also been having affairs on the side. I can't trust a word she says or continue to live like this. Each time, she has begged for forgiveness and promised not to do it anymore, until she does it a week later. We agreed to separate a month ago, but now she realizes there's not going to be any regular income from me and wants to stay married. When I told her no, she attacked me physically. I don't want the police involved. I have a daughter on the spectrum. Although she's a young adult, she will blame me and what relationship I have with her will be destroyed. I have been advised to not move out, as that can be seen by the courts as abandoning my property to her. Please advise, Abby. Signed, End of the Road. Abby writes, Dear End, the best advice I can offer you is to tell this story to the best divorce lawyer you can find. Interview several, and follow that person's advice to the letter. If you must remain on the property, buy a sturdy lock for your bedroom door and use it. If your wife becomes violent again, do involve the police and get out of there as soon as you safely can.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Judith Linden and Lisa Horsch. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.